So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today I have Charlie Peters. Hi, Charlie.
Hello there, Adrian.
So, Charlie, you work for Emerson, but first of all, can you tell us a little bit about kind of you and a bit about the work that you do?
Well, I've worked for Emerson for close to 40 years, and largely I work on future-type things. I certainly do a lot of the marketing work. In a broader sense, I've worked on initiatives called Enriched Business Models, where we take our classic or traditional hardware that we manufactured, and as our products become more intelligent, we look for how that impacts our business models. And so we try to do very progressive things that uses the information of our products and those around us. So my job really is to work with the businesses that are in our six different business units and help them think through how information impacts their products.
Wow, fantastic. Now, we were put together because Emily Kane at Fleischmann, one of your PR agency, was telling me about how you think that business-to-business communication is changing and how brands need to provide different customer experiences in this environment of constant access to information and transparency. And she said to me, Charlie's got some really interesting views on that. And I thought, ooh, that sounds interesting. A bit of an angle. And given what you've just told me, and Emerson being such a big company, I'd be really interested to hear your views on that.
Well, certainly I think the whole selling paradigm is changing. We see that it being acted out first in the B2C landscape.
Yeah.
And although that was predicted to happen in the first decade of this century, we were somewhat disappointed about the rate of adoption. But now we see that really accelerating. And by looking at how the B2C selling models are changing, you see that the role of distribution is really shifting. And some of the value add that distribution historically provided is being shifted over to more centralized forces, and so it leaves some traditional distributors with less of a role.
Yeah,
and it changes the economics of how we distribute our products. But I think the real insight that no one really has figured out yet is that there's certain of those dimensions, such as communication and ongoing support and tailoring solutions and support to individual customers and how they're trying to operate their business in their locale. I think we run the risk of leaving that behind. And so what I'm really thinking about now is how we come back and think through all the value add that our traditional selling models provided.
Yeah.
And pair that to what the new architectures provide, and then come back and pick up the pieces and try to figure out ways in the B2B world, ways to service and support our customers and you know, at the outset to even generate demand. That all focuses me on the word I'm preoccupied with, which is local.
Right.
And so what I'm working on is how do we do local in the B2B landscape in the future. One other force that's really independent, really influences this, which is the whole thought process of millennials.
Yeah.
Their expectation, their means of communication, how they go about their work, how the approach to their personal life finds its way over into their work life. And I think that's absolutely another dimension that plays into this, first and most obvious on the B2C side, but still increasingly on the B2B side. And as the decision makers relating to our products increasingly come from this generation, I think that that will be a significant factor in how we piece together this solution. And, 5 or 10 years from now, end up in the ultimate B2B selling model.
And do you have any sort of ideas about how that will be constructed or what will make that up or it right now, or are you still sort of piecing that together?
Well, I think that it's very much a hybrid model, and perhaps that's what confuses people. I think that if you go back 40 years when I started, we had local salespeople. And so we had kind of a unilateral approach to it, where the local relationship was either the salesperson and or the distributor that played that local role. Now we learn that a big piece of the value add in the decision making in the B2B marketplace is transformed onto the internet. So people use search engines, they query your company directly. And as you step back from this, you say, I'm still paying the same margin to the bricks and mortar of the traditional distribution model, but the value added they're providing is more limited. When you look over on the logistics side, you see that maybe having inventory dispersed in all these distributors is perhaps not the most efficient model. And furthermore, you go to more customization, you go to more products that can be tailored. When you go to solutions, they have more dimensions. It plays into configuration. And so the likelihood that you can inventory that capability in every one of your distributor locations diminishes, and you suddenly are exposed to a new entrant or a competitor that takes a clean sheet of paper approach. And we suddenly start looking at internet selling models that have dramatically different economics. If you do that, though, you kind of can fall victim to shifting totally one way or the other, and you forget that millennials care about relationships. Millennials are in constant contact. So you start to think, how do I do kind of the social side of B2B selling and support? And when you look at that, that's something that I don't think can be centralized on a national and global basis. And then you start contemplating, well, how do I satisfy both dimensions? And that gets you into this hybrid model that has kind of global or national scale dimensions to provide content and approach, and to be the central repository of the inventory. And then you have a local dimension that tailors the product and the solution to the individual customer and stays in the communication flow at a very local level, so it's relevant and trusted.
That's really interesting. It also makes me think about a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I guess as we march into the future, is not to lose the lessons of the past, is the first thing that occurs to me. Particularly the idea about almost old-fashioned service and how you had trusted local agents that you would go to where the relationship was paramount. And then, but I guess the second thing is, so second and third thing is how we talk about hybrid model. You talk about this, you'd have to be very smart on how you link up the central with the local so they understand each other and there becomes like a information exchange or feedback loop to, so
That's
that you help and learn.
ab yeah, that's absolutely it, Adrian, and it needs carefully contemplated information flow models. I think the term you picked up on, which is agent, is really very descriptive and accurate. But when you think of the role of the center, you think of kind of configuration and the ability to tailor. You think of a logistics model that optimizes. And then you think of big data and analytics that amalgamates the information from each one of these local nodes and gets greater insight by bridging all this information and dealing with a larger database.
Sure.
When you think on the local side of the hybrid, you want representation that can have a local face in case there's a problem,
yeah,
but that understands the kind of the social setting, the industry setting for your customers, and is engaged to ensure and to modify or tailor what the kind of the national communication flows or information approaches are to tailor those to the local situation. So there's kind of dramatic roles in both, and as you suggest, it's really critical to figure out how we bridge those.
Sure. I think there's also something to, I mean, just something that occurs to me, there's possibly something to be learnt for, and I'm sort of loath to say this, but there's something to be learnt for how intelligence agencies gather information and then disseminate it and centralize it and analyze it, but then push it back out again. If you understand what I mean.
Well, I've found great insight. I haven't done intelligence agencies yet, but I've found many war paradigms, many military paradigms,
that actually give me a lot of
insight into this.
Yeah.
And the one that's most interesting to me is in a book that I'm reading now called Out of the Mountains by David Kilcullen.
Mm-hmm.
And David talks, out of the mountains means that in recent history we fought guerrilla warfares in mountainous regions, but he points out that there's a dramatic increase in urbanization.
Yeah.
And he talks about how future wars will be fought in urban environments, and when you read his book, he's really describing that the world's going to transform into probably hundreds of really important cities.
Yeah.
And his theory is that these are all going to be on the coast. Well, the coast is really a proxy for trade.
Yes.
For trade and transportation and a lot of people flow.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about the B2B world, your customers, by definition, are in the trade flows. That's why they exist. That's why they're supporting you. That's why they're buying your products.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of parallels, and when he talks about how you fight these wars in the future, you know, I see a lot of insight into how we have to compete in the future. And he breaks it down even further. He takes locales and talks about their development and governance models and builds up three different models of governance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about it the same way of several different models of industry structures and how they evolve locally.
Mm.
And so I haven't thought about it in the intelligence world. Probably with your suggestion, I'll go investigate that.
Well, I just...
There are three parallels.
Yeah, well, I think so. I mean, I think when I say intelligence and the military, they're very close to each other, I think. And so therefore, there probably is, you know, very similar lessons to be learned. But tell me, that must have implications.
Well, let me say one thing.
Okay.
In business, actually two dimensions of this. There's a country-based locality.
Yeah.
And then within large nations, there's a city-based locality.
Yes.
So perhaps I can deal with Austria as an entity and call that roughly a locality. But when I'm in the United States or China, if I'm in China, I'm worried about Xi'an versus Chengdu versus, a coastal city.
Sure. Yeah,
that makes
sense.
Each one of those distinct situations.
So tell me, the other thing that, because you think about with all this change happening, and you mentioned millennials and future generations and things, is this impacting how you recruit people, given the sort of the future needs of the organization and these future business models?
Well, for the first time in my life, I favor people under 25 years old as opposed to over 40. And so is a dramatic domain for the young people to get their teeth into what I think is the next big phenomena that this generation is going to deal with. So, you know, I started to work in 1975 and got out of business school in 1979, and I had the fortune to be thrust right into the globalization trend.
Uh-huh.
And the world was shrinking, transportation costs, so travel costs and logistics costs were declining dramatically and shrinking the world. And then the overlay of the information age really paralleled almost my entire career. And so I kind of feasted on globalization. And, you know, even today I do some of the same work that I did in 1979. So I have deep experience in global product planning, per se. Well, I actually think if I was coming out of business school today, I would pay very close attention to this phenomenon, which I call glocalization. That's a word that's floating around. It's the same phenomena as globalization, but it's got this hybrid dimension of a heavy dose of local.
Sure.
And this glocalization, I think if someone was starting their career today, is something that they could really focus on. And the reason for that is, as you suggest, it's hard for a baby boomer or a Generation X person to really, really understand the social and community aspects of this. And as I say, the decision makers will become, the millennials will become an increasing percentage of the decision makers as we roll these models out. It's going to take us 5 years to figure this out. It's going to take us 10 years to impact. By the time you get 10 years from now, the millennials will make up certainly the majority of the decision makers in the B2B world.
I think that's fair. I mean, I do, however, there's another chap, his name escapes me, but I talked to him some time ago, and he introduced me to an interesting concept, which he called young brains and old brains. And he suggested that people, as they get older, they become almost lazy in their thinking and get stuck in norms, and therefore they develop these older brains, which have less of a, if you like, plasticity than younger brains do. But actually, they say what he suggested was actually this is not inevitable, and this is something that we can actually, as we get older, we can retain this young brain syndrome by what we expose ourselves to, how we think, what we do, all of these different sort of things. So I would suggest that it's not all over for the baby boomers and the Generation Xers. There is some kind of chance, but they've got some work to do.
So could I ask you to get that guy's name? Because I want to go face-to-face and really attack him. Because at age 58, I hope he doesn't think that I have a totally old brain, but let me give you a word, curiosity, that I think is the driving principle underpinning what you suggest. And as long as those of us remain curious,
yeah,
and remain open to what we know and what we don't know, as I get older, I have less intellectual energy.
Yes.
But I'm actually more efficient when I draw on my experience. And you know, I have the advantage to see the pace and the inertia that new ideas have, and can apply that. So, for example, I mentioned earlier e-commerce. It was originally predicted to transform the world of retailing in the first decade, and it didn't happen. But at least I have enough experience at this age to know that if an idea is right, even if it doesn't happen, eventually the appropriateness of it will outweigh and overcome the barriers to adoption. And that forces me to choose and emphasize people to work on things who can persevere and who can sustain their effort and work through these things. And that, by the way, is what this phenomena that we're discussing here will take. It's not going to be obvious at the beginning how you do this, and it's going to be a collision of old ways, new ways. It's going to have to coexist with existing channels.
Yeah.
And you're almost going to have to graft it on to your traditional approaches. And all of that is fraught with barriers and resistance. And we're going to have some pretty strong-willed individuals who will persevere through that.
Well, I think also it's possibly that it's going to require... Actually, I just remember the name of that chap. The chap's by the name is called Tim Drake, by the way. And he would agree with you that it's underpinned by curiosity and a thirst for understanding and questioning things. But going back to your point, I think this idea about not knowing the answer, as it were, and having to graft things on sort of implies that it's going to be a very much an iterative approach, and possibly one that's going to require firms to do things, but then do things that may actually not work. And therefore there is this idea of, well, we might fail at this in a small way, but that for many firms, that might be anathema to their culture. So there has to be a bit of a cultural shift to move this, and that might just come with the new people, but it's a bigger, there's a bigger organizational dimension as well.
So you asked me here in this first question to tell about yourself, and perhaps that's what you would say. I'm really intrigued by problems I don't know the answer to, and that's why I'm so fascinated at age 58 to be able to tackle this one, because I literally don't know the answer. The beauty of this problem, and you even alluded to it with the word small, is because it is local, in a large sense, you can kind of pilot this by just choosing a location and going and trying it.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
The negative is you don't necessarily have the gravity of the national content and, you know, kind of the overarching things that the center has to provide. But you can certainly... And this is what we're doing. You can certainly go try to form these agencies and take on these challenges and make it an iterative, piloted process that grows and is a learning mechanism.
And so tell me about the... So going back to this idea around the big central sort of idea and the information flows and things that we were talking about earlier and the part that's going to play. I mean, there's another big phenomena and buzzword that's floating around, which is big data and analytics, particularly predictive analytics. I mean, do you see that as playing a bigger role in the definition of these models and how we're currently doing business and how we will start to do business in the future?
Yeah, we're deeply into predictive algorithms and frankly have been surprised at how rapidly we're able to put in place really accurate and insightful additions for our customers. And I think this very much plays into the role of the center. And it actually cannot be done locally. The idea will be to draw on the insights of the center and tailor it to the individual customer or the individual situation. But it's going to take a lot of work on architecting the information flows and building these into these central databases or data lakes, as people call them,
yeah,
and then mining those for insights. But I see the agent dramatically dependent on the center to provide insight and therefore to be interesting to their customers.
See, that's really interesting. And you use a word there which is really interesting, funnily enough, pardon the pun, but it's when we talk about, originally we talked about relationships, and the reason why the word interesting chimes with me is that I have this concept that I talk about, when I talk about relationships, and they're built on sort of two dynamics, as it were. Now, assuming that we've got respect, like, and trust in there as hygiene factors, let's say. But when I say to people that if you think about most good and sustainable relationships that you have in your life have these two dynamics in them, and those two dynamics are interesting and interested. And I think if we think about that in a business context, we think about it from marketing traditionally has tried to be almost exclusively interesting in a way, to try and catch somebody's attention. But whilst we're seeing a shift to companies trying to be a bit more interested in their customers and try to be a bit more helpful and a bit more, you know, useful and valuable, etc. But actually, but also to understand that in true relationships, those dynamics, they shift. The emphasis shifts and changes depending on the context, which sort of plays in with your model around the center and the agent and things and how they can learn from each other and how they can tailor things, draw from the center, but also tailor things to the end, you know, the end user at the local stage. Does that make sense?
Yes, in this paradigm we're discussing, I think the word interesting is synonymous with the word content.
Yeah.
And I think interested is synonymous with the word support.
Right, yeah.
And what's missing in this simplistic concept of the next generation of B2B, where you go to a central selling model that transacts over the internet, is this second dimension.
Yeah.
And I'll only tell you an anecdote that I picked up last week. I got a call from a salesman, and I was with his unit general manager, and they were telling this story about how they had a series of tools out on a job site, and they had a problem that all seven tools on this one job site were failing.
Uh-huh.
And the salesman called up the general manager, who they'd known for many years, and he said, you know, I'm going to have to go to this job site, and I'm really dreading it because I'm going to have to face up to seven out of seven failures.
Right.
Goes out to the job site and calls the general manager back, and the general manager said, was it as bad as you thought it was going to be? He says, well, interesting thing happened. I took the guy's seven tools, worked through him what was wrong with him, and convinced him that we could fix him, and he gave me an order for seven more.
Yeah, funny
and
that.
That is the value of being local, and with the term you've given me, interested.
Yeah,
that's very much a valuable dimension of what I'm suggesting.
So, in your experience, Charlie, and sort of thinking about all this and driving the thinking and change around new, innovative global business models, and you know where your thinking is going. I mean, A lot of people just haven't really started thinking about this and haven't really started on this on this journey, as it were. But from your experience, I mean, what would you say to somebody that was listening to this and going, "I think that might apply to us, but I have no idea where to start"? What would you say to them?
I think that they're going, the key thing is that they have to think about building a new channel to their customer that is an adjunct to their current network. So don't fear having to make a choice between your traditional mode and this futuristic mode.
Right.
Think about convincing your traditional channels that this is just the next turn.
Right.
And this is just the new next competitor that they think about. And remind them, if they look back over many decades, they probably faced a lot of competitive challenges.
Yeah.
And remind your traditional channels that this is kind of a pilot and an iterative thing, and that the best will find a role to play in this new model.
Yeah, so
so think of it as a pilot and an addendum, as opposed to a replacement. And I think if you do that, you can start to at least reduce the fear and start to think about how do you pilot and get engaged with something.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, it's almost like it's an evolutionary thing rather than a completely transformative thing.
Right. And therefore, as we suggested earlier, you need to say, this is the model that's going to dominate my channel structure 10 years from now, and get your hands wrapped around this millennial thing. And you're going to have to bring in some new people and really trust them. And I mean young people.
Yeah.
Because even you parse the millennials into different generations,
yeah,
and you have really got to get people who feel comfortable with this constant communication and the trust of the community that they hone, as opposed to the trust of some national brand that traditionally has dominated some B2B category.
I mean, I think also I would say to you that if you want to get your head around it, there's something that you mentioned earlier. It's that, and something that I like to focus on is who is your customer, but don't necessarily think about who is your customer now, but who is your customer going to be in the next 10 or 15 years?
Well, I think a lot of traditional manufacturers and competitors in this space would make two errors on that analysis. Who's their customer? They think of their distributor as a customer.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed.
So that's the first hurdle I have to get. And my, the phrase I like on that is the distributor has no money.
Yeah.
The distributor is just a conduit for money. Mm-hmm. It's the end user that has money.
Yeah.
So, I'm not real interested in selling to somebody who doesn't have any money. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is exactly as you suggest. The target may be moving.
Yes, absolutely.
And big data can really help you hone your targets to find what part of the marketplace do you add the most value to, especially if you start considering predictive diagnostics and some of the more technical aspects of big data. It can really, really start to hone in. Where do you have the most value to add to a customer? And that gives you your most fertile target segments. And there you go. You've suddenly given your new agent in some locality the key targets to go after.
Yeah, I think so. I also think there's the other thing that I've experienced in the past that I've always found very useful is I used to work for Shell a number of years ago, and Shell was always famous for doing scenario planning and
right.
And just looking, trying to build scenarios and look at different scenarios and which were basically pictures for the future and ascribing kind of likelihoods onto them and then almost like working backwards from there to think, well, what does that mean for us and our business? What are the implications? What are the trigger points? All of those different sort of things. So there's some real useful things around, I think, that like that idea of scenario planning, but thinking way, way forward, but with a mix of learning from the past and financials and economics, but also learning from, history and anthropology and ethnography and all of those different sort of like social sciences that can help us learn from the past, but also build a picture of the future as well, and a future that we then become better prepared for.
Well, that's very much how my mind works. I like to paint the final picture, and then I find it easy to draw the bridge.
Yes.
But in the context of this conversation, this concept of urbanization is really, really critical. We're going to from where 20 to 30% of the world's population lives in an urban environment to where the majority does.
Yeah.
And that has dramatic implications on a number of dimensions, social and the like. The structure of industries, the structure of logistics, and that is a very, very big phenomena that's layered into this discussion.
So. Excellent. Charlie, that's fascinating. I mean, I'm just conscious of time as well, but we've talked about quite a lot, actually. I know, but I'm thinking, is there anything else that you'd like to add before I sort of start, just before I wrap up? Because my head's bursting now. I've got all these things kind of like flying around in my head now.
I'd just like to acknowledge that we did make it past 25 minutes.
I sort of suspected that we might, actually, but that's fine. But then there's a final question, Charlie, that I always ask people that I speak to on the podcast, and that is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Well, I think that for most businesses, this is a kind of a foreign concept. And Emerson's involvement in this enriched business models, the transformation of our traditional hardware products into these intelligent products, and then in a broader sense, what I call intelligent product ecosystems, is the first dimension of where I think we operate a very progressive company.
Uh-huh.
And then I think in parallel, how we sell and service and support customers remain interesting and interested, as you suggest. We're exhibiting the same type of progressive thinking on that side of the equation. And this is one where you have quite a significant first mover advantage.
Absolutely.
And, along a lot of dimensions. And I think that that speaks very well about the future of our company.
Well, Charlie, that's been a joy and fascinating. And so thank you for that. That's been brilliant.
All right. Well, I've learned a few things. I wrote down interested and interesting from you. And I think there's some special dimensions of this conversation. I'll probably listen to the podcast.
Fantastic.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.